Welcome to the Wild Adventures podcast, the podcast where we get to hear people's life stories and see where they have identified adventure in their life. My hope for you as a listener is that you come away from this podcast inspired to make every day an adventure. I am your endlessly curious host, Marlene Lowe. My passion is in hearing and collecting your stories. So today I was joined by Nicole Webb. She's a journalist and a former television newsreader from Sydney, and she went from being the newsreader in Sydney to being a mum in the middle of China. So this interview is really about her book, China Blonde, and it's a true story of reinvention, love, humour, and finding your place in a brand new world. It's an amazing story of being an expat in an unknown world. So I really hope that you enjoy this. I can personally attest to loving her style of writing and not being able to put her book down. So enjoy. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Oh, let me just put my camera on. Hang on. There we go. Here I am. Hi.
Sorry, I'm a little late. I was trying to set up the camera to work and it's not, so stuck with the FaceTime now.
Oh, are you on FaceTime? Oh.
Well, not FaceTime, the webcam as opposed to
the web. You've got a proper camera, have you?
Yeah, I do photography for fun. So when I started the podcast, I decided once I got a handle on the podcast, I thought, well, let's try something new. And so I started adding the video as well.
Good idea.
So busy with my day job that I haven't had time to test things. And then it was like, yeah. I got so wrapped up in that I was like, shit, I don't have
Oh, no. Oh, well, you look good anyway.
Thank you. I had my mother's help.
Oh, did you? I know, I was contemplating now, should I put my contacts in? And I'm like, no, it's 8 p.m. on a Saturday night. I've got a little glass of wine here. I've just like shoveled my dinner in and I'm like, okay, don't disturb me, husband, child.
Thank you so much for doing this. It's so exciting.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's great to do this. It's been really fun doing all these different podcasts and getting to know different people, and really good.
When the email came through, I was like, me? I was so shocked.
Gosh, why not you? Of course. I love it. It's just, I think it's perfect for the book, it's perfect for what I've done, and great. It just, just gelled with everything.
I've got to say, I am loving the start of your book. I cannot put it down. I
haven't finished it yet,
but I'm absolutely adoring it. The story is just amazing.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It's so weird at the moment, to actually think that people are actually reading it. It's out there.
Yeah.
It's still quite surreal. I went into a bookshop earlier and I was looking for it on the shelves. I'm like, it's probably, down the back hidden somewhere. And it took a while. I found it. It was kind of near the front, but on the bottom shelf. But it was still surreal. I thought, is that my book? Like that really, I said to my husband, I'm waiting for that aha moment when I go, I wrote a book. It hasn't happened yet. You're like, it'll happen one day.
I'm sure it will. I know I was listening to a radio show a few weeks back, and it is a bunch of authors that do it. And they said that all of their publishers have told them to go into the bookshops and move their books forward. Yes. So they're at the front.
Exactly. That's what we did.
offer to sign the books as well so that they've actually signed. And
I said to James, I said, I'm not going, but you need to go. I couldn't find it. And, there's just so many books. I'm like, okay, James, you need to go to the counter and ask if they've got it. And I'm just going to hide down the back of the shop. So he went up there. And just as he got there, I found it. And I'm like, stop, it's here. And he's like, no, I'm asking. So I quickly ran down the back of the shop. And then they came and pointed it out. And then he actually moved it up. So it was a more prime position.
Nice. Proud husband.
The things you do, hey?
So tell me about the decision to actually write the book.
Oh, gosh. Well, I keep saying this, I sound like I'm repeating myself, but, you know, as a journalist, we all like to think we've got a book in us, you know, in us, I think. That just kind of goes with the territory. And, you know, as a kid, I loved books. And I think there was a point when I actually wanted to be a librarian so I could just be around all of the books. I just always knew it was something, you know. I used to write a lot. People are reminding me when I was like a teenager and in my 20s and lived at uni away from home that I would write these long, long letters that just went on for days. So I think it was in me, and I just didn't really know what it would be about. And then of course I started the blog when we moved to Hong Kong from Australia, because I just had started doing a bit of freelance writing for websites. And I thought, you know, we're in this crazy, amazing place. I should start blogging about, you know, the things that we're doing and seeing. And that just gave me a taste for that creative side of writing, I think, which is quite different to journalism. You know, when you're doing a news story, it's very, you know, what, why, when, how, where, and that's it. And it's short, sharp. So this gave me that insight into creative writing. And of course, when we moved to Hong Kong, China, sorry, from Hong Kong to Xi'an, that was, you know, as soon as I stepped foot into on China soil, I thought, yeah, this is what the book has to be about. In fact, the minute that I knew we were going, I thought there'll be a book in this for sure, because I knew it was just going to be so different to anything that we'd done. And, you know, I just wanted, and then when we were there, of course, I just really wanted to try and get across. I knew I wanted to tell the story of the real China and what that was like, because, you know, beyond those headlines that we're seeing around the world, especially right now, you know, all we see is China and the economy and the Communist Party and the government. And I just thought, what about the real people on the ground? Because I was in a second tier city in China. So, you know, it's quite different to those first tier cities of Beijing and Shanghai, and a much less, well, you know, it's sort of like going back in time. So I kind of wanted to explain that, but I just didn't know how I was going to write it. You know, didn't even know where to start.
That's given me chills. Like you say, you knew a story was going to come. It's like that sixth sense that you just know something's going to happen.
yeah. You just know it will be something, but what, you know, I didn't know. And I think it took me probably a year into living in China until I found my feet and, you know, felt comfortable, I think, to actually start doing some interviews. And I put my journalism skills to good use. And I had my best friend, you'll read about her in the book. She came with me. She was Chinese and she did translate a lot of the interviews for me. So, yeah, we interviewed people from all walks of life, you know, which of course you'll read about in the book and that. But it was fun. But I still had no idea what the book would be until I got back to Australia and started doing a lot of different, you know, writing courses. I had access suddenly to all of those courses and, you know, learned how to hone the craft, I guess. And everyone said, you know, you've got to be in the story. I'm like, really? What? They're like, yeah, it's got to be about you and your adventures. And I'm like, oh gosh, I didn't plan that one. So then I'm like, okay. So I started learning, you know, what memoir was and how that worked. And that's, you know, a snapshot of your life. And away we went.
I suppose, yeah, because as a journalist, you're used to writing about other people and not necessarily being that center of attention and the center of a story.
Absolutely. It's always about other people and showcasing their stories and telling their stories, which, you know, I was good at doing and I could do that. But when they say, you know, you've got to put yourself in it, I'm like, oh dear, how, you know, how does that work? And it was hard the whole way through, just trying to understand how, you know, that would work and what to tell and what not to tell and what sort of secrets to give away and how much emotion to divulge. Thank God I had some great editors that kind of stopped me from looking too much of an idiot. I was like, okay, they're like, cut this bit out. We don't need this bit, you know? So like, okay, good idea. Probably didn't need to know that, did they? And then they said, you've got to be on the cover as well. And I was like, what? No, I never envisaged that. I was like, are you, you know, surely not. And this was the publisher and the editor, my mentor. And they're like, yeah, it has to be you. So Okay, here we go again. So that's still a bit weird. You know, when I said I went into that shop today, it was kind of, I said to James, that really doesn't even, I don't even, you know, click that that's me on the front cover. It just doesn't connect still, you know, it's weird. Yeah.
I want to take you back to before, to your 20s when you decided to go into journalism. So you've always had a love of writing, but was journalist always the career path that you wanted to take?
Oh, gee. Well, look, if I'm honest with you, it's a funny story. I was in the career guidance counselor's office at 17, you know, when we're in the last year of high school and they're trying to work out what you're going to do and what degree at university you're going to do. And I didn't really know. And I was, you know, some teenager dreaming of Hollywood and Tom Cruise. And she looked at me and said, you know, well, can you sing? Can you act? And I'm like, no, I can't do any of those things, you know. And she's like, well, Hollywood's probably off the list. And she's like, what about a journalist or a newsreader? And I'd obviously deep down in my subconscious always admired the newsreaders and always thought that would be a great job to do. But I was such a shy person and a shy kid, you know, I was like the reddest kid in the class if you asked me to do a speech. Yeah. But it's so, friends that knew me in primary school and high school couldn't believe I became a newsreader. Yeah. But anyway, I said, okay, I'm going to become a journalist, you know, not really knowing what that meant, but knowing that it involved writing and interviewing. And, you know, I thought, well, that might lead me to Tom Cruise. Who knows? You know, the dreamy teenager. So, of course, I applied for university courses and ended up, I didn't get into the one that I chose, ended up getting into a course that was quite far away from home and had to move away and do all of that. But I became quite, I guess that showed how determined I was, because by that point, it was kind of no looking back. It was like, I'm going to be a journalist, and then I'm going to be a newsreader, whatever it takes. Mm-hmm. So off I went at 18 and, you know, finished my degree and, you know, got lots of people told me at the time, you know, I don't think you're going to be a newsreader. It's too difficult. You know, that's not going to happen, or, you know, you're not cut out for it. Mm-hmm. And then when I finished uni, of course, it was really tough to get a job as a journalist in a country town. And I was just like, you know, I was waitressing and doing a lot of work experience, you know, working for free at sort of local TV stations, you know, handing out coffee and that sort of thing. And It did seem sort of an insurmountable thing. But I persisted, and I ended up getting a job in radio at a country town in Australia, which wasn't as a journalist. It was as a salesperson, of all things. Okay. But I thought, okay, well, that's in media, so it's a start. So I went and started doing that for a few years, which it was, you know, it was fun, but it wasn't my thing, you know, try to sell radio advertising. And I still wanted to be a journalist. And so I'd made these show reels on tape back then and send those out to all the news directors in all the country towns, and got lots of rejections again, and just kept going. And I think something happened and I decided to leave the country town, and my parents were in Melbourne in the south of Australia in a big city, and I thought, I'll go and live with them and give myself a year to get into journalism, and if that doesn't work, I'm going to have to go back to sales or PR or something. So off I went, and on the way, I remember driving on my own. It was like a 30-hour drive, and I drove all the way from this town in the Queensland, Rockhampton, to Melbourne, stopping at every single small news station and meeting with the news directors. Like, here I am, hoping that if they met me, they would go, okay, we'll give you a job. Yeah. didn't happen, sadly. I got to Melbourne and still got a part-time job in a bank as a customer service operator, and still kept doing the work experience, what have you, at the local TV stations. And I think the year was almost up and a news director called me and said, you know what, you are the perfect example of persistence pays off, and I'm going to give you a job. It's in this little town called Tamworth, 30,000 people, New South Wales, and you can be a journalist for a country TV station. I'm like, yes. It was kind of like, have you seen that movie? Oh, it's an old movie, Up Close and Personal with Michelle Pfeiffer. It was kind of like her journey trying to become this journalist. So off I went, and so it began. And by that stage, I was 25. So kind of a late starter, you know, in that. Yeah.
It's giving me chills. So how did you get from there to Sky?
So I did a couple of years there and kind of cut my teeth and, you know, did all those stories from local big tomato contest to council stories to, you know, double murders, all sorts of things happened. And then I went to the Gold Coast, which was further north where my family were then, and did a year. And then I decided to move to what was the big smoke in Australia and moved to Sydney and did a lot of, you know, part-time freelance work. And one of those places was Sky News. And yeah, I just kind of started working my way up the ladder, I guess, there. They had a lot of programs that I started producing, like The Book Show and Showbiz and a political show and an eco report show and health news, which is when I started doing a little bit of presenting. I got to do some interviews, and I was really set on being a newsreader by that point. And yeah. Sky News, you know, it's kind of like Sky News in the UK, obviously not as big or anything, but it was a 24-hour news channel. So lots of different shifts, lots of newsreaders required back then. So lots of opportunities. So it was just a matter of, you know, working my way up and, you know, trying hard to learn how it was all done until I got an opportunity.
You definitely had to stick to that dream then and be really tenacious and not give up and just keep going.
It's funny. I didn't realize, I kind of haven't realized how tenacious I was until I've done the same thing a bit with the book. Yeah. And I thought, yeah, there's a pattern here. Yeah. You know, a lot of people say to me, you know, it's not normal what you did when you drove around to all those TV stations. I'm like, really? Oh, okay. You know, and I kind of took the same approach to writing the book is, you know, just again, when you get rejections, just thought, I'm not giving up and I'm going to find another way.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I've done.
It definitely shows a passion for what you do and a passion for sharing stories and sharing your knowledge, definitely.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's, if you have a passion, I guess you really, you have to really want to do something and really crave it. And, you know, I always used to visualize, you know, I was putting together this keynote talk, which it's sort of how to live a life less ordinary. And it made me think of how I've done what I've done, like what steps I've taken. And I think I've always sort of visualized whatever sort of represented success for me, like at night before I'd go to bed, like when it was being a TV journalist, I remember I'd lie there imagining me with the microphone and, you know, the cameraman and the suit on and doing a little piece to camera. So I think that's sort of, I don't know whether that's kind of, you know, putting it out to the universe or whatever it is, but it's kind of what I've done, I've realized.
That's some solid manifesting there.
Isn't it? It's strange when you think about it, but yeah, it's just how I've worked.
I'm a huge sucker for a love story. And as you said in the first couple of chapters, you focused on your career and then got to 35 and had that one last date. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. Oh gosh, yes. So yeah, I had some long relationships in my sort of mid-20s to mid-30s, which didn't work. They weren't right for me and I wasn't right for them. And I was 35 and, you know, thinking a bit like Bridget Jones, this is never happening for me. You know, I'm just, you know, I remember waking up on my 35th birthday and had lunch or breakfast with mum and dad, just crying, thinking, you know, I think I'm never going to meet anyone and I'm never going to, you know, have a baby or anything like that. And it's kind of distressing. And, you know, you just wish you had a crystal ball and stopped worrying about those things. That's what I tell everyone now that's always saying, you know, I don't have a partner. I'm like, don't worry about it. You know, it's such a waste of energy. But that is kind of the turning point where I decided, you know, I sort of finished it for once and for all with this past partner and kind of finished that. And, you know, I had done a lot of work on myself. I'd done a lot of counseling and kind of worked out where I was going wrong and why I was choosing the wrong people.
Yeah.
And I decided, okay, look, even if I'm going to be single for the rest of my life, or I don't end up having children, I'm going to enjoy my life and I'm going to make the most of it. And that's when I decided to go and do something for me. And I did, well, yeah, for me and others, I decided to go to Africa and volunteer for 6 weeks. So that was sort of the catalyst, I think, to sort of start changing things.
Yeah.
It does, doesn't it? You know, it's just one of those places, isn't it, where it just really tears at your heart. So, but just before I did that, and I'd been on a few dates that year, but oh my God, disasters, you know, just don't even go there. It's just like, why am I doing this? You know, it's just awful. And a girlfriend said to me, do you want to, she had asked me earlier to, did I want to meet this guy? And I said, I'm just not ready. And she said, no, I don't think you're ready either. And then a few months later, she suggested it again. And I said, okay, well, you can give him my email. And he must have emailed me just before I was going to Africa. And he just sounded really nice in the email. And so I said, okay, well, maybe we can meet for a drink. And so it was one night I'd been on air. It was raining and I'm, you know, driving over the bridge, not knowing where I was going, to some strange suburb that he thought I was working near, which was nowhere near where I worked. And, so I got there and I remember going into this kind of dingy bar and ordered a glass of wine and knocked that back for courage, and then just kind of waited and thought, you know, this is it. I really am not having another date after this. It's too nerve-wracking. It's just too stressful. And along came James, and he was just normal and nice, you know, and we sat down and we just talked about life. And he was from England, so he had come over as a backpacker, so he knew what it was like to travel and all of that. And he was just interested in me and, you know, just different, which was nice. And I'd said to him, look, one drink and that's it. I had a funeral the next day, which he probably thought was a likely story, but I did. And but then I ended up going for dinner. There was a restaurant next door, so we had dinner and it was just easy, you know, really easy. And but I was obviously a bit wary of, you know, dates and that sort of thing, so we sort of said goodbye. And I think we might have had another date or two before Africa, and I was still a bit, you know, umming and ahhing. Like, he was really nice, you know, every time, but I was sort of focused, I guess, on getting to Africa, and this was a big trip for me. And when I was in Africa, we could get to use the internet occasionally, and he'd emailed. And but then by the time I came back, you know, a couple of months later, I was like, yeah, you know, forget about all that. I'm just not even interested in men. And, but then he left me a voice message maybe a couple of days after. And he was just so nice, you know, that British charm. And I was like, oh, my God, why is he so nice again? So I said, okay, look, I'll meet you again. And I met him again. And, you know, every time we'd sort of meet, I'd think, look, he's really nice, but that's probably the last time. But it just kept going. He was too nice. Yeah. So, and he just, you know, kind of convinced me to give it a go. And he stuck with me, you know, through all my crazy tendencies of, you know, is this going to work or not? And 11 months later, he proposed. And, you know, I thought I didn't have to sort of say, is this, where are we going with this? What's going to happen? It just eventuated without all of that, you know, which was so nice and so normal, which I'd never had. So, you know.
Sounds like tenacious as well.
Yeah. So that was 13 years ago. So it was worth going on a blind date. I implore people do it. You never know.
So with him, he's an expat and moved about. Where did your love or interest in being an expat come from?
He said to me when on one of those early dates, he's a hotelier, and he said, you know, they like me to sort of move around and move up, obviously, all the time. You know, overseas opportunities are obviously huge because there are so many hotels. And I remember just saying distinctly, no, you know, I'm not going overseas, because I guess at that point I'm 36, you know, 37, I thought, you know, my time has come and gone to live overseas. I felt like that was something you did in your 20s, even though it was something I would have loved to do. And I was also very focused on my career. And I thought, you know, it took me a long time to become a journalist and a newsreader. So I kind of said no. And he was kind of okay with that, because he had come to Australia and loved Australia. So we kind of left it on the back burner for about a year and a half. And then Hong Kong came up. And he kind of dismissed it instantly. And I don't know, I just remember talking to my mum about it. She said, you should just go, you know, you live once. Yeah. And we'd been to Hong Kong, mum and I, together a couple of years earlier. And I just thought, you know what, she's right. You know, I could be doing exactly the same thing in another decade. And I guess I'd sort of lost a bit of my ambition because I'd been doing that for 10 years by this point at Sky News. And I had lost that sort of mojo to keep going. And, you know, I wasn't pushing myself really. I was reading the night shift and coming home at 1 a.m. So I think I just thought, you know what? So I said to James, I think you should just put your hat in the ring and do, you know, let's see what happens. And he's like, really? So he did, and he got the job. And I think you might have read in the book, I found out I was pregnant as well in the same week. I was like, oh my God, you know, double whammy. How's this going to work? Geez. So it was all very, you know, it was happening quickly with hotels. You know, I think he was had to go in about, you know, 6 weeks. And we had to just, you know, what it's like, pack up the house, rent it out, you know, sell the cars, get rid of the pet, put the cat somewhere, and off we went. And, you know, and then get to Hong Kong, obviously, and find doctors, and because, you know, I was having a baby and hospitals, and it was all, so it was a big step back then.
No regrets.
No regrets. No regrets ever. It was an amazing time. We just absolutely loved it. You know, of course, the first probably 9 months, I always say it's like a pregnancy. It takes that long to get used to anything, doesn't it? You know, you like being, your body's foreign to you for 9 months. It's like that in a foreign country, and it was all very strange and, you know, culture shock, even though Hong Kong is very westernized because of that British influence. It was still different, you know, that there was a lot, you know, Cantonese was spoken mostly. So you get in a cab and you couldn't tell them where you were going, and the food was all very different, and the shops and, you know, the people. But it was a great learning curve, and we ended up really in loving it. We were there for 4 years and really found our home there. We lived on the 43rd floor of this skyscraper, which was 70 floors high. It was crazy. And that was next to the hotel where James worked, the W in Hong Kong. Underneath that was like a sprawling shopping center with an ice skating rink and a movie theater. And it was just, you know, everything was at your fingertips, really. A train station underneath. And you know, it was kind of good and bad having a baby there, because having her, I didn't have a car because I couldn't drive there. So I've got the stroller or the pushchair everywhere you go, and it's very hilly and steps everywhere in Hong Kong. So it took me a long time just to work out how to get anywhere with her. And, you know, just having a baby is difficult anyway, isn't it? Like, it's foreign enough without being in another country without your family. And luckily they came over a lot. So yeah, it all worked out well.
So how did you find, what was it that you could do to help you get over those culture shocks and adapting to a new place? Because you did that in Hong Kong, but then when you moved into mainland as well. So what do you think you had that helped you adapt?
I think in Hong Kong, I ended up joining a like a mum's group, a pregnancy group, where we were all pregnant at the same time, due at the same time, roughly. And I had always been one of those people that I'm not joining a mum's group. That just sounds horrendous. You know, I thought, no. But I really kind of thought, if I'm going to meet anyone, you know, I've got to put myself out there. And that, I think that's the hardest thing. I found that in China too, just stepping out of your comfort zone and meeting new people that are so different, or you have no idea who they are. They're not introduced via a friend. It's like going on a blind date, isn't it? Yeah. And it's just, oh, it's so hard. But you kind of just know you've got to do it, because once you just need one friend that you can have a coffee with once a week, I think, and that will be enough to kind of sustain you to keep going. So I knew I just needed to find one person that I really connected with. So I remember, you know, being quite heavily pregnant, sort of walking through Hong Kong's crazy jam-packed streets trying to find this pizza place where we were meeting, and I couldn't find it because you just get lost all the time in Hong Kong, and yeah, you can't ask anyone, and you know, sweating and a big belly, just thinking, oh, again, like going on that date, what am I doing and why? And then eventually I went in and there was probably a dozen women, and they were from all different countries. Some were from Hong Kong, America, England, Dutch, you know, so it was just a melting pot of cultures, and it was weird but nice, you know, and it was just you meeting people. And of course, out of that, I did meet that one person that is still a really close friend today, that, you know, got me through and introduces you to other people. So I think that's a big thing, is to sort of, you've got to find, it's cliched, but find your tribe eventually if you can.
Yeah.
And I think I also just knew that, you know, nothing's forever. So if it didn't work out in Hong Kong, we could always go back home.
Yeah.
And Sky kept my job open for a year. So that was kind of comforting, yeah, that I knew if we really hated it, then we could just go back. It's not the end of the world. But of course, by the time you get through, I think that first 18 months, and if you really start to enjoy it, then there's sort of no return. you don't want to go back by that point. I remember we got offered a job back in Australia, and it was maybe 2 years or in, and we were just like, I just don't think we can do it. You know, we're not ready. You know, we've just started to really embrace this new adventure, and we just found our feet, you know, because it was hard, I guess, having a baby as well. I couldn't immerse myself into the real Hong Kong life where everyone's going out and enjoying a few drinks. And, you know, I couldn't do any of that. So, and then of course, sleep deprived with a new baby, you know, you couldn't really get into it as much. So it took more, probably longer that way, I guess, to really start enjoying Hong Kong for what it had to offer, and, you know, not being so half dead every day.
Yeah. So in Hong Kong, you learned about being a mom and what that journey was, new areas. But what did you learn about yourself when you were in China?
Wow. So going to China was just a whole different ballgame, really, because so that came up on the cards because James needed to get a role as general manager of his own hotel. So, you know, other sort of hotels kept popping up around the globe, and he would put his hand up and some would sort of fall through or wouldn't happen. And China kept coming up and we kind of kept avoiding it. And then it was just, it kind of got to the point where it was just, like, we even got offered a job in Wuhan, and we went up there for a weekend to have a look at it. And we turned it down in the end. And because it's just so different once you cross that border from Hong Kong, and, you know, there's really the English is so much more minimal and it's so much less westernized. But, you know, it was clear that China wasn't going away, and eventually Xi'an came up, and I remember just Googling it to see what it was like. And it looked really nice because it's a very quintessential Chinese city. It's, you know, got lots of lanterns and old buildings and historical temples and pagodas. And I remember saying, James, well, it looks kind of nice. I think we're just going to have to do it. You know, it's just, we're going to have to get it over with. So, he said yes, it was the Western there, and off we went. And Ava was 3.5 by that point, and everyone in Hong Kong was like, oh my god, you're really going to China? So that makes you feel like, really? Yes, I am, you know. I'm not sure why, but we are. And then we got there, and oh wow, it was kind of, you know, the hotel was beautiful, and, you know, everyone was very friendly, but it was just such a culture shock because it was so different. And it was like going back to the 70s with people smoking everywhere and inside, and just crowds and hordes of people. And I think not many people had seen a white person, so they were quite fascinated. And, you know, when I say fascinated, I mean they would just come at you when you went outside of that hotel door. And because it was a bit of a tourist spot opposite us, so there were lots of Chinese from all over the country. So many that had come from kind of rural villages that might never have seen a white person except for the movies. So they were just amazed, especially by Ava, you know, because she was quite fair and long blonde hair. And, you know, they would just try to get at her. And, oh gosh, I just remember the first few weeks, my heart was in my mouth. I thought I was cut out, you know, for being an expat, and I thought I'd done well in Hong Kong. And I remember just thinking, I don't think I can do this. This is really just too hard. And I also didn't want to meet any other expats because I think in my mind, I'd met my group of expat friends, and right. they were in Hong Kong, and I was never going to find anyone as good as them. Yes. So there was no point in my head. So I kind of kept up that charade for about a month, and Jane's parents came, and that was sort of kept me from having to go and meet people, and we were hanging out with them a bit, and then they left, and I was just like, oh, my heart sank, and I'm here I am again, just knowing no one. Mm. And I couldn't really have a decent conversation with anyone apart from James, and he's obviously at work all day. So it was very isolating. And then we had to put Ava in school. And in China, it's school for a three-year-old from 9 to 3 every day, mm. 5 days a week. I was like, wow, this is pretty intense. And it was an international school. And that's kind of where I started meeting other expats. And there was only a handful in Xi'an, maybe 100 tops. I don't know. It was pretty small. And that was probably 3 months in. So by the time I started meeting people, I was ready. I was like, you know what? Yeah. I really need someone else to have that coffee with and just talk yeah. about this last year.
So you're not so long.
Yeah. And just putting yourself, again, it's putting yourself out there and scouring Facebook, trying to see if there are any, you know, other people in Xi'an, you know, that you can meet. And one of my best friends there had seen my blog because I was blogging a lot from there, and she had messaged me to see if there were any hairdressers that could do blonde hair in Xi'an. So that's how we struck up a chord and ended up we met for coffee, so another blind date. But yeah, you know, you win some, you lose some, and then that one worked well, and we became really close friends. And you know, I didn't replace my Hong Kong tribe, but I found another one as well. Mm-hmm, so yeah. That's
and
the beauty
end up
of it.
Having lots of tribes in lots of different countries, but the benefit is that of that is no matter where you travel, there will be someone that knows you that you
yeah.
can get to know the local communities instead of just the tourist hotspots.
And that's amazing, isn't it? Just to yeah. know that you know all these people from all over the world, you know, it's really quite a special feeling to know that, I think.
Yeah. So what was the decision to come back to Australia? I don't want to give away too much of the middle part.
Well, I guess, again, we were in Xi'an for 2.5 years. And by that point, we'd found our feet and, you know, we were quite enjoying it. While it was really tough still living there, you know, because we had our group of friends, you weren't so alone. Ava was settled in school. You know, we had worked out how to get around. It wasn't such it wasn't so dire if my phone battery ran out when I was out in the yeah. middle of Xi'an, because in the beginning you would just be like, if this runs out, I don't know what I'm going to do. I can't speak any Chinese. How am I going to even get back? I don't even know where I live. So, you know, by the time I'd been having Mandarin lessons, so I could have a basic conversation at that point. So I could hold my own if I was out amongst it. So I felt much more confident by that point. And I guess it's like any expat, there's always that conversation, and you'll know it just comes amongst all of expat chats. It comes up, doesn't it? When are you going to go? When's the time to call it a day? When do you yeah. give up and leave this life? And it's the never ending question that there's really no right answer to, I think. And we were loving it. Expat life, and we probably could have kept going. I think we could have easily, and I'm not to say we won't do it again.
Yeah. I don't think it's something that ever leaves you, is it? Once you're an expat, you're always an expat. There's always that calling to do
something. I think so.
You don't always listen, but there's always that subtle calling saying, are you coming out again?
Yeah, I don't think you can say, well, this is it, I'm back in this country for the yeah. next 20 years and that's it. I think you've just got, once you, it's addictive, isn't it, to be yeah. in those places that are hard and difficult but thrilling at the same time. Mm-hmm. So yeah, a job came up in Sydney, and we were just sort of umming and ahhing, I guess. And of course, it's Sydney, it's our home. Well, it, obviously James British and I'm from New Zealand, but that was our home together, and also family, you know. And Ava was 6 by that point, and that starts playing on your mind, doesn't it, that you have to, you know, you want her to be near her grandparents, at least one set. And we just felt if we said no, we might not get back to Australia. And it was just one of those things. We really didn't know what the right answer was. So we just kind of tossed it up in the air, and we said, okay, let's just do it. If it happens, we'll do it. Yeah. And we weren't really ready, and it was really tough. But here we are, and you don't have any regrets. You just kind of you adapt, don't you? I said that to someone the other day. Doesn't really matter where you are, as long as you've sort of got your family, and I think you can adapt to any situation and make it home if you let yourself.
How do you think Ava's been? How it's formed her life?
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't really know. I always ask. Other people say you can really see that with her and her personality and her outlook. I can't see it as her mum, but I hope somehow that surely, I mean, she can't remember Hong Kong, but she remembers Xi'an. Yeah. So I just hope somehow growing up in that international world, you know, where she might have only been one of two white people and it was just normal to be around lots of different nationalities and seeing so much, even if she doesn't remember, I hope it's sort of formed somewhere in her mind that it shapes her a little bit as she grows up. Yeah. I can't really say one thing that I can see, but as I say, other people do say that you can tell that she's led that sort of lifestyle. So it's going to be interesting to see, I guess, what she's like when she grows up, and does she want to live overseas or does she just want to stay put? Because you find a lot of like kids that have had to move around are like, I'm not moving anywhere now, you know. Yeah. And she's very settled here now, and she's like, because I sort of put it out there, oh, do you want to move? We might move to Singapore, what do you think, you know? She's like, no way, no, I'm staying here, because, you know, nine years old, it's all about friends. We're like, oh, okay, so we might have to wait a bit longer. so who knows? Yeah.
And does she say she's Australian, or does she hate getting asked where she's from? Like most of the
Americans. Yeah, she's funny. I think she's such a mix, because I'm a Kiwi, James is British, she's got Australian citizenship, but she's born in Hong Kong. We always tease her, she's our little honky girl. Yeah. And I think she does, she kind of likes saying that now. I think she'll probably enjoy it more when she gets older. There was a point, I think a year or so ago, when I said, do you want to dress up in your Chinese dress for Harmony Day, where you can dress up in international costumes? She did not want to be known as the Hong Kong girl, you know, it was too embarrassing. But I think as she matures, she will be proud of that, you know. That'll be something unique. Yeah.
So what's the next big adventure? So you've got the book written now. Do you already have another adventure on the go?
Yes. Well, at the moment it's just kind of getting that book out there and into people's hands to read it. And that's obviously been a huge adventure for the last 2 years, just making that happen and learning how that works. And it's just another world. I am writing another book, a fiction book set in Hong Kong, about sort of women and friendships, similar themes, but fictionalized and, you know, the modern day woman, I guess, the career woman, all sorts of women, you know, that come together. So that's as far as I've got with it, but I've written a little bit. But I said to James today, I really need to start getting onto that as well. Yeah, and you know, my husband's still working in hotels, and so we'll see where that takes us in the future.
And last question for you, what advice do you have to anyone that wants to be an author?
Oh gee. First of all, know that it is a really tough path. But again, it's one of those things, if you love to write and you want to do that, then do it. You know, don't let that stop you. Because I think that's the hard part. And people always said that to me, the difference between being an author and not is just not stopping writing. Yeah. You know, that's it. Just do it. Because so many people have got a book in them, and so many people want to write a book and can, but they just don't finish it. So I think you've just got to do it. And then once it's done, then you can go through all that nitty gritty of working out how you publish it and all of that. And it's not easy, but it, you know, it can work out. There are lots of ways to do it. And you'll find a way that works for you. So just write and get a group, a workshop, or a small group that can help critique your writing. Because I had a group, you know, we were all amateurs, and that really helped me in the beginning, even just coming together every few weeks and showing them what I'd written. And, you know, they could say, well, that works well or that doesn't. And then once I got to a certain point, I could go on to a more, a group that of seasoned writers that really knew their stuff, and find a mentor that really helped to edit it and shape it. So yeah, just get lots of help, I think, and join lots of groups, do lots of courses, and I think that's the way to do it.
Thank you so much for taking the time. You've got a lifelong reader in me now. I can't wait.
Oh, thank you.
All other books that you release in your lifetime. You're very talented at writing, really captivating. I honestly can't put the book down. It's really, really nice to read.
Oh, thank you. That's so good to hear, because as I said, it's really weird to think people are actually reading my words. And so it's really nice. I'm glad you're going to be a lifelong supporter. Thank you.
Another inspiring story, and just in time to take on a new weekend. If you want to share your story or join the Wild Adventures podcast community, make sure to look us up on our website, which is www.thewildadventurespodcast.com, Patreon, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Redbubble, all of which have links in the show notes. If you like what you heard on today's episode, then leave a review wherever you listen to episodes. Podcast episodes and help spread the stories. Till next time, my wonderful wildlings, I hope you have a fantastic weekend and you have plenty of adventures to share with us come Monday morning. Bye!